You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert will be back on Monday. Coming up, it's our weekly look at news from around the state, including the latest on Wisconsin enrollments for coverage under the Affordable Care Act. First, the U.S. has a vast network of national and state parks, which many people consider one of the nation's great treasures. But according to a report by the Outdoor Foundation, a small proportion of park visitors are non-white. Considering that these outdoor spaces were created for everybody to enjoy, why are so few people of color taking advantage of this big heritage? Well, my next guest is an avid adventurer who has grappled with that question. He's got a new book out that explores the causes and possible solutions to what he calls the adventure gap. James Mills joins us in the studio. He's a freelance journalist, independent media producer. He climbs tall things, and he's the author of The Adventure Gap, Changing the Face of the Outdoors. James, thanks so much for joining us.
Rob, thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
So give us a little more detail. What do you mean by the adventure gap?
Well, I have been in the outdoor recreation industry for almost 25 years now, and as a person of color, I continue to see myself as one of the few people of color in the business of outdoor recreation, but also whenever I go out into the wilds of the national parks or to recreation areas or to wild and scenic spaces around the country, I'm continually one of the very few people of color that I actually see, and my anecdotal experience is affirmed by statistics that indicate that as a percentage of the population, African Americans, Hispanics, Asians, people of color in general tend to spend less time in nature than do their white counterparts.
We'll spend a lot of time talking about how to reach out to new audiences, and I'm throwing new in air quotes there, because in your book you say this isn't really so new. There are stories of people of color intimately involved with the creation of national parks and American wilderness. Why haven't we heard about these stories? Why is it important that we do?
Well, that's a really good question because, frankly, again, as someone who's been in the business for a long years, it wasn't until the year 2008 that I heard about the story of the Buffalo Soldiers mm-hmm. and their experience in Yosemite. And very few people know that in 1903, 1905, 1906, African-American horsemen of the U.S. Cavalry were instructed by Teddy Roosevelt under the advisement of John Muir to go out and patrol the parks. And for that time period, there were actually over 400 African Americans who were intimately involved in the creation of this particular national park, as well as in Sequoia and in Yellowstone. And believe it or not, a lot of the work that they have done actually helped to create the standards that are recognized as what the National Park Service stands for today, which in 2 years will be 100 years old.
Now, when you, in your book, you talk about this, when you look at outdoor magazines, you don't see many people of color. When you think about, when you picture maybe a mountaineer in the United States, you don't picture a person of color. So what message does that send, say, to a young African-American person in a city that they don't see that?
Well, very specifically, I mean, I've had young people tell me personally that it's not for them. Mm-hmm. You know, and that creates a paradigm of that's a huge problem. I mean, when you have young people who decide that because of their race or because of where they're from or because of their lineage, they don't think that it's something that they have a legacy to embrace. They don't have an opportunity to be able to say that this is something that it, not only is it for me, but it's part of my heritage. And when you have young people who self-identify out of becoming involved in outdoor recreation, that means that future generations will be less likely to spend time outdoors.
So I guess one big maybe bad question is, so what? What do they lose? What do we lose if that audience isn't connecting with these outdoor wilderness adventures?
Well, I mean, technically, you know, It's really not a problem per se, but if you look at the changing demographics of America, it's estimated by the year 2042, a majority of the country will be non-white. So as the population shifts to favor a non-white majority, if a majority of the population has no affinity for the outdoors, if they don't have a vested interest in spending time in nature, there's a good chance that the areas that are protected by federal legislation, by federal tax dollars, if those areas aren't apprised, they will be defunded. There will be situations where these areas that we embrace and love and enjoy, frankly, won't be protected either by legislation or by federal allocation of funds.
Well, let's dig some more into the causes of this disconnect. One you point to is low-income people. Often there's an overlap with African-American and other minority communities simply don't have the resources. How big a part of the question is that? What can we do about that?
Well, I mean, I think that, socioeconomics is always brought up in this with the presumption that outdoor recreation is an expensive pastime.
Which I imagine it is. Maybe I'm wrong.
Well, I'd like to think that it's not because, I mean, if you take a look at what it takes to go camping, mm-hmm. you know, relative to what it costs to go to a theme park, you know, it costs $35 to $50 to get into a theme park like Disneyland. It costs $20 to get a family of six into Yosemite or any national park in this country. For $80, you can get a national unlimited access pass for a year to the national parks. So when it comes to the economics of it, it really isn't necessarily a question of it costing too much. Now, definitely camping equipment can be expensive, but it doesn't have to be. I mean, you can get a good tent or a sleeping bag or a backpack, you know, at a general purpose retail store for relatively low money. So it's not really a question of socioeconomics so much as a matter of being able to recognize that it's something that's important to you and ultimately worth the monetary investment.
And another part of the picture is you say the legacy of segregation policies and racism. How did that contribute to this adventure gap?
And that's an area that I'm going to relegate exclusively to the area of theory. And I think that a lot of people in the academic world can attest more specifically to what I believe are some of the social problems. But, you know, when you take a look at the situation of Jim Crow laws in the mid 20s through the 1960s, where areas of this country were segregated by where people could live. Essentially, if you were a person of color in this country, you were almost required to live in a city. There was no opportunity for people of color to actually purchase homes, per se, in the suburbs. Ultimately, that makes it virtually impossible for people of color to spend more time outdoors simply because of where they are allowed to go simply because of their race.
We're going to talk about solutions to this. I want to give a little tease for that. Now, you've worked with groups who bring kids out and try to overcome this adventure gap. Can you just paint a picture of the first reaction, somebody who spent their time in a city and all of a sudden they're out climbing Denali or some other challenging mountain climb?
Well, I think it's really important that people don't start their outdoor
right,
recreation experience at a climb like Denali, which is the highest peak in North America. In fact, the group that we took on this particular expedition, many of whom didn't have advanced mountaineering experience, we actually took several smaller, less ambitious trips to smaller, less ambitious mountains all over the country. Frankly, once you take a person who's spent a majority of their time outdoors and give them an opportunity to actually spend time in nature, even if it's just a state or local park, being able to spend time away from their desk, away from their offices, away from their homes, away from their classrooms, and being able to spend time in nature, it's a wonderful opportunity to be able to establish a relationship with nature.
And there's a quote, I think, I'm not sure which participant it was, but said, "I felt like I discovered something I'd been missing and didn't know I'd been missing." Is that a pretty common response?
You know, it really is, because I think that so many people attribute a lot of their identity to the things that are around them, specifically their homes, their cars, their computers, their cell phones, their laptops. All these devices ultimately create kind of barriers to the outdoors. And I think that once we give them the opportunity to actually spend time in nature, people, regardless of their race or ethnicity, if they are primarily in an urban environment, it's a great way to experience things that are completely different from their personal experience.
We're exploring what our guest James Mills calls the adventure gap, a gap between how people of different racial and ethnic groups use the nation's outdoor spaces. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Have you seen this adventure gap here in the U.S., and why? Are you not a white person, and do you find yourself and your community avoiding wilderness spaces? Why do you think it came out that way? And if you're an avid outdoors person, what do you get out of it that you think everyone should have a chance to experience? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll continue our discussion with James Mills, author of The Adventure Gap, coming up after the news. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about the adventure gap, the relatively low numbers of minority group members who take advantage of the country's vast resources for outdoor recreation, for wilderness adventure. And you can join the conversation. Have you experienced what our guest James Mills calls the adventure gap? What factors contribute to it for you? What suggestions do you have to help change it? And if you have a story, maybe you grew up in a city, about your first time encountering nature, or if you're an avid outdoors person and want to make the case that everyone should have a crack at enjoying the wilderness, call and tell us why. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can tweet us at Central Time WPR. James Mills stays with us. His new book is The Adventure Gap, Changing the Face of the Outdoors. James, you do a lot of outdoor adventure, mountain climbing, among other things. What is it? What is it that we get out of it? Why do you do it, apart from because it's there?
And I love the fact that I'm having some difficulty even coming up with an answer to that question, because I think it's different for everybody, you know. And I personally, enjoy the physical experience of being in natural spaces and being in areas that are wide open, you know, fresh air, clean water. I've recently taken up fly fishing, you know, and that's something that I really enjoy and have had a few opportunities to do in various parts of the country. And I think that is, if people would give themselves the opportunity to branch out, you know, to go outside of the norm or the online experience, I think that they'd find a variety of different exciting and very interesting activities outside.
Now, in your book, you talk about programs and organizations that try to bring that experience, so for everything from fly fishing, I think, to mountain climbing, to the audiences we're talking about, maybe to urban minority populations. Could you share some of the examples with us of groups doing this kind of work?
Well, one organization in particular is called Outdoor Connections. It's an organization in San Diego, California. And Outdoor Outreach is the name of the organization. And they do incredible work getting kids involved in sports like snowboarding and surfing. And one young man in particular who's profiled in my book, his name is Ryan Hudson, up until the age of 14 was homeless, had actually spent his entire young life living on the streets, and found himself in an at-risk youth a residential program, and was exposed to snowboarding. And long story short, after spending years involved in this activity, he's now a professional snowboarder for the North Face, and was actually on Denali with us during the climb last summer. And I think that, someone like him working with organizations that have exposure, mentorship, and opportunity can do anything. I mean, literally go all over the world. And one of the things that I make it a point to outline in my book is to illustrate the various stories of young people, both men and women, who have the opportunity to get that exposure, get the experience, but most importantly, adult participation and supervision from older and more experienced people around them to give them the opportunity to experience the outdoors in a positive and proactive way.
Let's get to a caller. We've got Esperanza on the line in Milwaukee. Esperanza, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, I just like to comment that in the 50s, we came here from Puerto Rico, and we lived in Milwaukee, and the way we were exposed to nature and the outdoors is through the Girl Scouts, and they would take us out camping, and we got to learn about how to be self-sufficient, how to make campfires and produce meals out there and really enjoy nature, and if we didn't have that experience, I don't think now I would be able to do that with my grandchildren and my children to appreciate the outdoors as a result of that.
Esperanza, thank you so much for sharing that story. So much there that we could get into. James, let's start with the intergenerational. Once you get one generation involved, does that give you a chance to create a new picture of who goes out into the wilderness?
Absolutely. Esperanza, thank you very much for your call. And I can tell you just from my own personal experience, I was a Boy Scout and was a Cub Scout from the age of 9. And literally up until the day I graduated from high school at the age of 18, I was able to spend time and experience time outdoors throughout my entire young adult life. And what was especially interesting, though, was that my dad at the time was not an outdoorsman. However, he had the opportunity to become exposed to the outdoors through other adults in our community that helped him to help me to form the relationship with the outdoors that I enjoy today. And frankly, had it not been for those early experiences, I'm pretty sure that it would have been much later in life that I would have discovered any relationship with the outdoors. And I think it's important, especially at a very young age, to get involved and hopefully get involved with an organization like the Boy Scouts or the Girl Scouts.
Esperanza, thanks so much for sharing your experience. We'll go now to Lori with us in Green Bay. Lori, hi.
Hi. I grew up in the country, so I always enjoyed being outside and exploring out there. And I just always thought that maybe these days, instead of having sports programs, that maybe we should have something where all these kids can enjoy trips, whether it's to the city or to the country, just to get them out of their towns or their cities so that they can see that there's something else out there. And the sports really are just for, a few kids, and it's not for everybody. I think even if they had trips at certain times of the year that would, just take kids out into parks or get them out doing some of these activities like hiking and biking and canoeing or rafting, whatever, I think that would help everybody instead of it just being, the sports kids.
Lori, thanks a lot. So the schools is part of the solution here, James.
No, I agree. And actually, I participated in several varsity sports in high school, but scouting was still a part of my growing up. I think that it should be one of the many things that kids get exposed to as physical activity, regardless of whether or not they're on a team. People can go camping, they can go biking, they can go canoeing, rafting, skiing, a wide variety of different outdoor activities that they can do as a group. But I think what's really interesting is that you have a very specific, very personal relationship with the outdoors that is completely divorced from individual experiences as a group activity. So I think that if schools were to have outdoor recreation as a priority, it would be a great way to expose young people to an experience in the outdoors, as well as give them the opportunity to establish physical fitness and create a healthy lifestyle.
Lori, thanks so much for that call. You, James, quote some people in the book talking about, there are role models in the sports world for people of color, not so much in this wilderness adventure world you're talking about. And you profile a couple that I'd like to get into a little. Shelton Johnson, a ranger at Yosemite, maybe a role model himself, but he also points toward the Buffalo Soldiers we were talking about earlier.
Yeah. Shelton actually wrote the foreword to my book. And for those of you who aren't familiar with him, he was prominently featured in the Ken Burns documentary, The National Parks, America's Best Idea. And he's actually currently the only permanently stationed African-American park ranger in Yosemite Valley. And what's interesting, and he's pointed out on several conversations that I've had with him, that 100 years ago, there were actually more people of color who spent time in Yosemite than there are today. And so historically, I think that there are many opportunities for us to take a look and see how people of color have specifically engaged in the outdoors, going back all the way to the very beginning of our culture of outdoor recreation in this country.
Well, another story you point out that I had no idea about was a North Pole explorer.
Right. Everyone, well, actually many people have heard of Robert Perry. Commander Robert Perry made it to the North Pole in 1909. However, very few people realize that he had a silent partner, an African-American man by the name of Matthew Henson, who was right alongside Perry all the way up to the North Pole. And Perry himself said, had it not been for Henson, I never would have made it to the pole. Now, what's especially interesting about his story is that Henson trained the dogs. He built the sleds. He spoke native Inuit, and he was the single most experienced person on the expedition, including Perry. However, when it came time to share the accolades for this acknowledgement, Henson was literally left out of the history books, and it wasn't until Dwight Eisenhower recognized Henson's contributions to the discovery of the North Pole in 1953. And even the National Geographic Society that sponsored this expedition didn't acknowledge Henson's participation in this until the year 2000. So unfortunately, a lot of this history has been hidden, and a lot of it has been kept away from people who can definitely benefit from it today.
Back to our callers now with Bill on the line in Madison. Bill, hi.
Hello. Good to be here.
Can you hear me?
Yep, go for it.
Well, I just wanted to mention, in connection with the conversation you're having, a recent article in the Los Angeles Times discusses several critics. One is a guy named John Christensen at UCLA, who were saying that a basic problem for our environmental practice traces back to John Muir. He's arguing that John Muir's idea of nature and how to relate to it was essentially kind of elitist. Not that it's expensive to get into a national park, but that it takes a lot of time and travel to get there, and that it has appealed to a kind of well-off class of mostly white people. And also that Muir's thinking about nature reflected a religious sensibility that is kind of Calvinist in its foundations and is not perhaps consistent with those of, Hispanics who come from a very different kind of religious sensibility.
Bill, thanks for the call. So maybe some fundamental differences in the way we originally thought of wilderness in this country.
Bill, that's a really, really good point. And it's one of those areas that I think is at the core of the problem. And when we start talking about the adventure gap, I mean, that's really essentially how it ultimately has the ability to be created. I mean, actually you mentioned Hispanics. And when you think about how adventure or how outdoor recreation is codified, if you take a look at most national parks, campsite capacity is 6 people. Anything bigger than 6 people is considered a group, and you're required to have a completely separate permit for 6 people or more. Frankly, Hispanics have a tendency of spending time in nature in large groups. I don't think I've ever seen a group of Hispanic people in the outdoors in groups of fewer than 10. They bring the entire family along. It's a communal experience. You know, so when the National Park Service is essentially telling them that your group is different than other people in terms of how they recreate with nature, that runs afoul of their interest in being able to spend time outdoors. And I think ultimately the same thing is true of most people who recreate differently. People look at recreation in the outdoors as a solitary activity, something that should be self-reflective and alone. But there are different ways of spending time in nature, and large groups is definitely one of them.
Well, James, we'll leave it there for now. Thank you so much for joining us.
Great. Thank you very much for having me, Rob.
That's James Mills. His new book is The Adventure Gap, Changing the Face of the Outdoors.